Oh, welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Here with my panel of super friends, we have Sydney Brownstone, Stranger Reporter. Hi, Sydney.
Hey, Bill.
C.R. Douglas is political analyst with Q13 News. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Joni Balter hosts Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. It's great to have you all here.
Good to see you.
And you. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and we want to talk about the big news stories, and we typically focus on the Puget Sound region. This Harvey Weinstein affair is local everywhere because it's relevant to everybody. This week, rape and sexual harassment got a very public face when we learned that Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein is accused of raping several women, and he's been settling sexual harassment claims for decades, and many, many people knew about this and said nothing. The district attorney of Manhattan, for example, declined to prosecute Weinstein 2 years ago, even though he heard this audio tape that an Italian model made for the police. She's wearing a wire. You can hear Weinstein trying to get her to come into his hotel room, and it sounds like he says he's used to groping women as he had groped her.
You'll never see me again after this. That's it. If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
I mean, don't have a fight with me in the hall. Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now, and 1 minute. And if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can. Yesterday, you touched my breast.
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
But you're used to that?
Yes, come in.
Because no, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on, sit here for a minute, please.
No, I don't want to.
If you do this now, you will embarrass me.
Outside of New York and Los Angeles, rape and harassment in Hollywood has a Seattle connection ever since Amazon got into the film business. This week, Amazon suspended the head of its film and TV unit, Roy Price, after a producer said Price repeatedly propositioned her. And the actress, Rose McGowan, who says Weinstein raped her, has been tweeting at Jeff Bezos that his studio head ignored her when she warned him about Weinstein. This week, Amazon said, "We are reviewing our options for the projects we have with the Weinstein Company." So much more to say here. Sydney Brownstone, the CDC says that 1 in 5 women report they've been raped or have experienced an attempted rape. How much do you think the Weinstein revelations will change that?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that anytime women come forward and report what's happened to them, there is strength. There's strength in numbers. And maybe women who have been raped get a message that if they come forward, they won't be disbelieved. But I think that the thing to take away from this story isn't that there was just one bad apple in Hollywood, or even that Hollywood alone has a sexual harassment problem. It's our society and our culture's problem of male entitlement and our culture's rape and sexual harassment epidemic. And we should talk about the social and cultural conditions that allowed someone like Harvey Weinstein to commit these crimes over such a long period of time.
And will we? So do you think that's part of my question. Do you think the focus on Harvey Weinstein and Meryl Streep and Ashley Judd and, you know, and on helps this conversation become not about celebrities or Hollywood or any one industry? Are we widening the conversation or narrowing it?
You know, I think there's a lot of noise in here. So when you're talking about Meryl Streep, for example, who doesn't have a claim of harassment, and, you know, when we see all this news coverage that's asking different celebrities of their opinions, I think a lot of that is mostly noise. But I do think that there is meaning and significant power in the Ronan Farrow story, for example.
Ronan Farrow is the journalist who broke the story in The New Yorker.
Right. And he quotes directly from women who claim that they were raped by Harvey Weinstein or sexually harassed. And in their words, you can hear very similar patterns of thinking. That you hear guilt, you hear shame, you hear, "I don't think I would be believed." And you start to see that this is actually this process that a person might think that they're dealing with all on their own, or that this burden that they have to carry all on their own, is very similar for other people who have gone through a similar thing. And I think that's where we need to pay attention. And I think that's where the power of this story lies.
Yeah, people thinking they're alone. We could talk about non-disclosure agreements. There is so much to talk about here. I want to bring the rest of the panel in. Who thinks, Joni, that this Does this change the situation, this Harvey Weinstein affair?
I so much hope that it does. I hope that because we have institutions involved in helping, aiding, and abetting this. And if it's true, something like Creative Artists Agency, which was enabling all of this, and Weinstein Company enabling all of this.
How are they enabling?
Because they were directing people to go to the guy's hotel room knowing well what happened once they got there.
There were people, including women, whose job it was to be in the hotel room. So they're, it's comfortable when the actress or whoever it is arrives and then you leave the hotel room.
Absolutely. And so what the, you know, we all know that this is part of the longtime, very sick lore of Hollywood. You know, these young, beautiful women, most of them are 20s, go to Hollywood and they run into people like him who are abusing power. Hey, baby, I'll make you a star. But first, we'll just have this little moment here, me in my bathrobe, you in my hotel room. This is really sick. It was ongoing. It's not like this is a million years ago. This is now. Institutions were enabling and helping, and I hope some of those institutions fall, just like what happened with the housing and the banking crisis. Institutions need to own up to this. If they get sued, party on. I wanted to add something to Sydney's fine comments here and say that, you know, what freed many of these women, there are 30. That's quite a number, and they all have very similar stories. Each one freed the other. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives you a preponderance of evidence here to really understand this is overwhelming. It's ongoing. This has got to stop. And it's not just Hollywood. Let's not kid around here. This is throughout American business.
Snaps for Joni over here.
I think the issue is so big and the violations are so egregious and the story is so disgusting that it inevitably will change things. I think this has empowered a lot of women. As Joni has said, you know, every time one came out, it gave a little more space for another to come out. I think this will be seen as a watershed moment in people coming forward. And not just women, but men. Not men who, I mean, men who also have experienced abuse, they've come forward actually in some of these cases, but also men who are no longer going to sit silent and are part of the bandwagon.
How does that work? How does seeing Harvey Weinstein being an Uber creep change the wider culture, change men? Let's start with that.
An Uber creep who doesn't work for Uber, to be fair here, right?
Yes, well, I think the biggest change is going to be it does give space to women. And I think that's going to be the biggest thing. As women come forward,
because they'll feel more like they're more likely to be believed because it's on top of people's minds.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that really happens.
Absolutely. And I would say, though, I think this is a real watershed moment. It has been growing. I mean, the last couple of years, you've had pretty high profile examples of women coming forward and if you will, taking down very big, powerful men. I mean, Cosby, you had Roger Ailes at Fox, you had Bill O'Reilly at Fox. I mean, there has been more and more ability, more and more courage being shown by women. And I just think this is going to solidify that.
So this is also the story of how the mighty fall. And what another very important thing here about the Harvey Weinstein case is this. It has been known in Hollywood what he was doing for a very long time. This is a good quote, but it tells you how long we've known about it from Seth MacFarlane. On the Academies, he says, "Congratulations, you five ladies. You no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein."
And that was a couple of years ago.
Right? But like, did anyone listen or hear that? It was broadcast all over the world.
Right.
Hello.
I think the other message that it should send to men more than don't be a creep is don't be an enabler. And we've seen this on Twitter, right, when Rose McGowan went after Ben Affleck, because here's Ben Affleck on Twitter expressing shock and outrage and sympathies or whatever else. And she called him out. She said, "I told you about this and you did nothing. You're lying right now." And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think most every woman in the United States has had that experience where they tell a friend or a confidant or, you know, someone that they think will understand and take their concerns seriously, just for that person to say, you know, "Oh, that's a shame," or, "Oh, you were probably doing something to lead him on," you know?
Well, so that's where Weinstein went. He argued when this was coming out that this was all consensual. Yes, but here's an interesting thing also in the New Yorker piece that really, really detailed this. These folks, when this happened, so concurrent, when this happened, many of them, the stories were very similar. They told a husband, a boyfriend, a father, this happened. And when the New Yorker did their reporting, they went back. Did your person tell you this at such and such a time? And the answer was yes, in every single case, that they had told someone so they'd be believed.
So then I would like to hear interviews with people that these women told, and they also did nothing. Because does that happen?
Well, so that gets a lot of examples of that. I mean, Jane Fonda just came out a day or two ago and said Rosanna Arquette, I believe, was one of the people who have alleged rape or certainly harassment from Harvey Weinstein. Jane Fonda said, I learned about this about a year ago, and I feel bad that I didn't come forward then. And you know, people said, or someone said, well, why? She said, well, you know, I wasn't the victim. I sort of felt like it was Rosanna's story, and you know, Rosanna was going to come out when Rosanna wanted to come out. I mean, you know, there are plenty of people who are feeling guilty who were told at the time, but they're in their own conflict in some cases about whether they come forward.
Well, we know why the victims of this didn't come out.
Yes.
Because they went to Casting Couch Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they wanted their break. And they thought, if I say anything, and they were right, that there would be backlash toward them, that their names, they would be removed from projects, they would be trashed in the Hollywood press.
So they're telling this people happened. who are also protecting them.
Right.
Yeah, one more thing to say about that. Apparently, if the reporting's right, that Brad Pitt was going out with Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, 15, 20 years ago when she claims she was harassed by Weinstein. She told Brad at the time. Brad, reports are, confronted Weinstein. So, I mean, there are examples of actually...
Well, that's what I mean. So are Brad Pitt and Ben Affleck claiming that they were protecting the people who didn't want to publicly?
They weren't protecting.
Brad Pitt actually went to Weinstein and confronted him.
And said, don't do this.
Yeah.
Now, did he go...
That didn't help all the victims who came afterwards.
And he didn't know of the other victims, perhaps.
Maybe.
Perhaps.
Well, more than just confronting the one person who's been accused of horrible behavior, I think it's important for men to not be enablers in another sense. Like, this behavior, Weinstein's behavior, exists on a spectrum, right? And it goes all the way from quote-unquote locker room talk all the way to sexual assault. And so we need men to not be enablers at the very beginning of that spectrum, right? To say that, just in general, make statements that sexual harassment is unacceptable, that locker room talk is unacceptable. We need men to be fierce advocates for our rights.
But,
and you're there's a hard line in the sand. You're either on one side or the other. You can't remain silent. And I think this is important to talk about here in Seattle too, because we also know that when the accusations first came out against Ed Murray, a lot of people were silent, and they were saying, well, there hasn't been, you know, a court adjudicated process, but there haven't been court adjudicated processes here with Harvey Weinstein either. And I think we also need to be asking ourselves the question why people adjacent to power will first react in a way that defends that power instead of taking accusers seriously.
Well, I can, first of all, I want to expand on one thing you said. I want to expand on not just men enabling. In this case, we have women enabling over and over again. They worked for Weinstein. They may have been women that worked for CIA. I don't know that detail. Now to the Ed Murray thing. I knew you'd bring that up. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think there's a big difference, and I'll tell you a couple reasons why. So in the Harvey Weinstein case, we have 30 people speaking. Zero of them have a criminal record, as far as I know. In the Ed Murray case...
But isn't that making it about...
Hang on.
Yes and no.
In the Ed Murray case, at the time that we're speaking of, there were four. Some of them had criminal records. That doesn't diminish what happened to them. But in terms of people sort of waiting a little longer than the next person to make an adjudication, it does explain why that happened. And then let me make one more distinction. And I said it at the beginning. The other distinction has to do with an ongoing institutional abuse of power. In the Ed Murray case, again, this doesn't diminish what happened to the folks, but it was 30 years ago. It was a little foggier, whether you like it or not. That's my distinction.
I just say one thing about the complicity, if you will, of people who sort of knew about it or who were told about it, maybe didn't do enough at the time. They, in some ways, I don't want to defend them, but there is a sense in which they were under the same pressure as the actual victims were. I mean, this was one of the most powerful people in the country. I mean, this guy's tentacles, you know, spread far and wide, not just in Hollywood.
Could you not use the word tentacle?
In certainly democratic, you know, political circles and journalism. I mean, this guy could ruin careers. He could stop careers. He could make careers, yeah. Not just in media.
Yeah. So
there was a lot of fear among people who maybe were told about this that, oh, God, if I confront him,
yes.
My
yeah,
job's
I really, really, I am talking about this because this is not about Harvey Weinstein. Principally, right?
Right.
This
it's
is about our
culture.
Entire. So just because you brought up Ed Murray and Joni, you disagreed with that comparison. I just want to hear how you react to that.
I mean, Sydney. I fundamentally disagree with it. I think that when a person comes forward, we owe them the time to listen to them, no matter what. I mean, Joni, you're saying that things are foggier if they happened 30 years ago, but for the alleged victims that I spoke to, they were clear as day. They were.
I get that, and I'm not diminishing that. But I'm telling you that I think there is a difference between that. I do think there's a difference. Because I think memories fade, memories distort. Time does matter in this. Preponderance of evidence does matter.
Okay, well, there's so much. We really could spend the entire show and more on this. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact that Harvey Weinstein could go to jail because New York State doesn't have a statute of limitations on rape. And Washington State continues to choose to have that statute of limitations. And Sydney, you and I were talking about this. Why does Washington have a 10-year statute of limitations
right.
when
so
it comes to rape cases?
Just to clarify, it's 10 years if you report within the first year of it happening to you. If you wait, and for certain types of rapes, like lesser degrees of rape or acquaintance rape, the statute of limitations is actually 3 years. So for most of the rape cases, or most rapes, would fall into that 3-year statute of limitations category.
Which speaks exactly to my point, which is that even that sort of acknowledges that memory changes a little bit over time.
But isn't the courtroom the place for that to be acknowledged?
It is the place it's absolutely the place.
So then, but I'm saying, why is there a law that prevents it from even going to court based on the time that's allowed?
So the statute of limitations law is based on something called a common sense law or a common law. And it's based on several things. One of them is kind of what Joni mentioned, but it's this idea that evidence degrades over time. And I guess I'm talking about physical evidence, but it's also based on this idea that if something really happened to someone, they would prosecute it right away. And based on what we know about rape survivors and trauma and the court system and the way the court system deals with rape survivors, you might not want to prosecute it ever. I mean, I can speak from personal experience on that one, why I never, reported or decided to go to court. But that's a real deterrent. And I don't think we should ignore that.
Anyone want to respond to that? No? Okay. Also, we have, I mentioned the Amazon connection because we're now in the Hollywood business here. So we'll see, really, Amazon is anyway. So we'll see about all that. Just a small connection to Seattle's mayoral campaign is that this Manhattan DA who didn't prosecute Harvey Weinstein has donated to Jenny Durkin's political campaign. Does anyone think it's unethical for her to keep that money? The DA says we didn't have enough evidence to go to prosecute this case. And I'm no lawyer.
I think now that she knows what she knows, she could give it back and have a sort of an interesting press conference about that. Because I
wouldn't be surprised if she did give it back.
I think so too. I think so too.
It's you probably want to scrub your donor list of anyone associated with Harvey Weinstein. That's not going to hurt her to give that money back.
Okay, we'll have more to say actually about the mayoral campaign, and we're less than 2 months now from election deadline. We've got that. We've got the state Senate might flip from Republican to Democratic majority. So we'll get there, but we're also going to say more about Amazon because the company says it wants a second headquarters. How about one right near where the first headquarters is? Maybe not, as we found out this week. Stay tuned. You're with KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. with Sidney Brownstone, Joni Balter, and C.R. Douglas running through some of the big events of the week. When Amazon said, we want a second headquarters, did you really think it was going to be right next to its first headquarters? Because some Puget Sound leaders may have held out that hope, but this week Amazon's worldwide consumer CEO seemed to nail up that coffin. Jeff Wilkie told the GeekWire Tech Summit in Seattle, quote, we are excited about Seattle, but we want another place where we can also grow. And here's why.
It's room and talent and, you know, and sort of diversity of environment for people. I mean, not everybody wants to live in the Northwest. And I mean, it's been terrific for me and my family. But I think we may find another location allows us to recruit a different collection of employees. And that would be terrific, too.
By the way, what kind of person doesn't want to live in the Pacific Northwest?
I was like, dude, what are you talking about? Like,
well, I have an anecdote on that.
Yeah?
Let me first say, I don't think Seattle has ever been in the running for this. Exactly. I mean, everything the company has said from the minute they announced the idea of a second headquarters to Wilkie this week comes back to this idea of recruiting, and that it's important to be sort of a somewhere else to help recruit. I mean, they're going to hire 50,000 more people, and you kind of need to be in a place, another place that would attract people. And there are people that don't want to come to Seattle. Here's the anecdote.
See eggs in baskets.
I have a friend who works at Amazon based in New York City. Mm. He's got to come to Seattle every 2 months, it seems, about for some regional meeting of his division. And, you know, he actually doesn't like it. I mean, it's a day of travel each way, and it's kind of a pain. And
it wouldn't be a day of travel. If you lived here, you'd be home now.
Well, the fact is not everyone wants to. And if you had an East Coast location, some other location, it is better for recruiting. I mean, that seems to be the theme they keep talking about. Look at what other companies are doing. I mean, you have people coming here for that very reason. Facebook now has a big presence here. I mean, they're diversifying geographically. Apple has a big presence here. Google has a big presence here. I mean, you can't just be in one place and hope to get every engineer, computer scientist you want.
So the cat is completely out of the bag. They are not coming to the Northwest. The next day they told this guy, go out and say everybody's in play. It was like, ha ha ha, like we're so dumb we don't get that.
Yeah, Amazon issued a statement saying that it'll give serious consideration to every proposal from across North America, including from communities across the Pacific
just
Northwest.
Just cross out including and put excluding.
And by the way, it's King, Snohomish County, Tacoma, Portland, Bremerton, Vancouver, BC all competing.
Amazon has played this so brilliantly. You know, they went from just a couple of months ago, Seattle government sort of blaming them for just about everything that's gone wrong here. Too much traffic, not enough housing, every single thing. And now the entire country, including Seattle, Bremerton, Tacoma, Everett, you name it, is like begging them, would you look at us? Could you please, please consider us? You know, Amazon wants another location for a bunch of different reasons. Strategic, political, they need, if they're going to build another mini city of 50,000, they are clearly going somewhere else. I read a really interesting piece in the Philadelphia Business Journal that was posted by the great Dave Boardman of the Seattle Times, and they aren't going to Philly, that's one. But what they did was they looked at places where Amazon has been quietly building up its presence, and then came up with a list of five cities that might not be any of these, but they were Atlanta, Austin, Boston, Pittsburgh, and Minneapolis as places where they're already sort of ramping up, places where they might like to be, and said, look at those. And they, of course, didn't mention poor Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Take that.
I didn't realize until the Puget Sound Business Journal reported on it this week just to what extent Amazon gets subsidies and tax incentives all over the country. Whether it's implicit or explicit, of course, everybody is competing for the biggest growth Goliath that there is, especially given that it's a company in a field where it's not like it's got a lot invested in producing its massive airplanes in this one region. You know, I know it's more than ones and zeros, but still, you wonder whether with technology, are companies going to be more and more mobile and therefore more and more in a position to work the best deal?
Right.
For better or worse, you know?
I think it's also a question of how much these cities and counties are willing to sacrifice for this kind of nebulous idea of economic growth. Like, yes, in very real terms, Amazon brings a lot of people to a city, brings a lot of business from those people. But at the same time, with these tax incentives, it's also asking these cities, what are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to give to me? And how much money our cities losing in order to bring Amazon to a place? And in that loss of tax revenue, are they really going to help bring up the most vulnerable members of a society? Like, this gets to the idea of what trickle-down economics means, I think, for me, especially because the place that Amazon is likely to choose is likely to have very low overhead and, like, looser minimum wage laws.
I also got the impression that many of these cities are playing for the next call. In other words, they are putting themselves out, putting out these beautiful come here, knowing that maybe Amazon would put like a building or something there, or that another business would see this and say, why don't we go to Tacoma? Who doesn't want to be in Tacoma?
I think it's pretty clear also that they need more room. I mean, that language has been pretty consistent in their statements. And when you talk about adding 50,000 more employees, it's pretty tough to do in Seattle. I mean, they realize the effect they've already had here with basically 40 or 50,000 already. I mean, they've created, they're sort of the victim of their own success in terms of traffic, affordability. I mean, they know that they've sort of affected all this. And adding 50 more thousand to a pretty tight geography, I think they realize is not realistic. And don't forget, when they talk about 50,000 employees, it's really not just 50,000 people, right?
2.5 is the multiplier.
Some of those
right?
are married. Right? Some have kids or will soon have kids once they get here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every Amazon job, there's a sort of multiplier where, you know, deli jobs get created and dry cleaner jobs and sort of all the things that it takes to service 50,000 people. So 50,000 employees is more like 100 or 150,000 new people. And they realize that is simply not realistic. I mean, Seattle and this region just doesn't have the infrastructure, just hasn't been able to keep up with the growth they've already experienced here.
Yeah, it's not like a Denver that could extend into the mountains or something like that. We are hourglass shaped. That's what causes many of our transportation problems that are sometimes just hard to solve. We're always about 5-10 years behind what we need to be.
And their employees are in traffic, and their employees are having trouble affording housing.
Well, part of the problem why we aren't able to accommodate the growth that Amazon has brought in is because that revenue from Amazon isn't going back into public goods, right? So maybe we would have more public housing if there was a head tax, for example, which is something that the Seattle City Council is considering right now.
Yeah, is this the tax that
that's a couple the Amazon of the, tax, as we would call it.
A couple of counties. Are we talking? I want to make sure we're talking about
who called it
the same thing. Is because this week a couple of city council members brought up the idea of a business tax on just the top, 10% or so of Seattle businesses.
So everybody's been trying to get at this. It's true that Amazon used to be a really bad actor on taxes, but they've been paying their taxes. But when you're sitting here watching this impact, as CR said, of 150 people, not really just 40, I mean, it's bigger. One at least of the mayoral candidates and some of the city council candidates, including Mike McGinn, who has been on this show a couple times, have just been trying to get at it was McGinn who came up with the quote Amazon tax, which is a head tax.
Yeah.
You guys called it Amazon in here. So yeah, people want to get at it. It's wealth. People want a piece of it. You can understand that.
I also think that it is irresistible to create a bidding process among cities.
Oh.
I mean, if
it's
you're
genius.
Amazon and you've got this big carrot called 50,000 jobs and $5 billion in investment, you do all you can to get the bidding war going. And so there will be billions that will be, you know, the red carpet's being laid out in all kinds of cities and regions. And the fact is, Seattle was not willing to do that. I mean, Seattle is still trying to absorb current Amazon. I mean, Seattle isn't even bidding. That tells you something. That tells you whether they think they're even in the running.
But
Seattle
King
has
County
sort of signed
to.
On
King
to
County
like
wanted
a,
to.
A King County and Snohomish County have sort of teamed up to maybe get it, and they've identified like six cities like Everett and Bellevue and Marysville. Seattle is not even bidding for this.
Yeah, some people had said Seattle could put Soto real estate out there, but I don't think anybody believes, for all the reasons that we've said, that Amazon
Hansen.
Wants a second headquarters
Seattle
somewhere else.
No, Seattle is not as hungry, because we already have
how,
it.
How would the port
We're
react
not as hungry
to,
as a
to
city,
Amazon HQ2 in their little transportation
for a city that has a jobs
Mariners.
Problem and
oh, yeah.
has a lot of land, they will be throwing tax breaks, and if you're Amazon, you go there.
C.R. Douglas, political analyst with Q13 News, Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger, Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, will all be back with you to continue the week in review with some local politics. The new mayor of Seattle, who's it going to be? The state senate, which party's going to hold a majority? Somebody going to run the table in Olympia? And what would that entail? What would change if that happened? Stay tuned. C.R. Douglas, Sydney Brownstone, Joni Balter, I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. On Monday on this program, on The Record, Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon, the two candidates for the Seattle seat of mayor, are going to be in our studio, and I'd like to know what you, the listener, want to ask them. So tell us. I'll forward your question to them on the air. You can email us, record@kuow.org. record@kuow.org. As I said, Twitter at KUOW. You can go to our Facebook page, too. Let's talk about that contest. This campaign, I've seen polls showing Jenny Durkin leading over Carrie Moon. What would change that?
Hey, Bill, can I just add something to your Monday? Would you be super nice to them here in the studio so they're in a good mood when I host a debate with them at Seattle U that evening?
That evening, yes.
And send me your best questions.
I will, absolutely.
Is that shameless or what? Okay.
We can just start the debate a little early. Let's just consider that.
Yeah, let's just roll tape. It's
okay.
Good.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, campaign. It's less than 2 months away. The listener, have less than 2 months before the November 7th election deadline. So,
have less than 1 month, don't you?
October. Less than a month. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Oh my gosh. How time flies.
Yeah. It's like 3 weeks. November 7th. Thank you. Less than a month. So, what should we know? C.R. Douglas.
When you ask what would change it, assuming Durkin probably has the advantage. I mean, she had more votes in the primary. That's
a lot more money, too.
Yeah, a lot more money. You know, her biggest liability, if you will, is kind of her establishment, you know, connections, if you will.
Why is that a liability?
It just, in this day and age, it's a dirty word. And
you've been living here long?
And so
we have listeners who may not know what she means.
To the extent that she, you know, has been connected either through money or just sort of professional association with sort of developers and lawyers and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, fairly or unfairly, that is her biggest weakness, if you will. That's what Moon is trying to exploit. Now, it's not an easy box to put her in. I mean, here's a lesbian who, you know, fought for police reform, and, you know, so she's not quite this, you know, downtown, you know,
not the stereotype
executive. So, but that is her liability, if you will. If Carrie Moon can sort of make inroads on that, then that's where she has a chance. In this context of a ton of energy on the progressive left, the radical left, I mean, look at how well Nikita Oliver did in the primary. You know, being an establishment figure is not where you want to be.
I think it's more about, you make an important point about establishment politics not being in vogue. But at the same time, I think that this is kind of a boring race because that Durkin's biggest weakness when Nikita was still in the race was the fact that she was a former U.S. prosecutor, right? She was part and parcel of a system, like the criminal justice system, that has come under a lot of criticism lately for its disproportionalities, right? And that's something that Nikita was really running on. She was running on racial justice and racial equity. Now that Nikita is not in the race, that's less of a weakness, right? Because even though Moon is trying to adopt that language and you know, be an advocate for these disproportionately targeted communities, she's not coming from that experience, right? She's not coming from the same experience that Nikita had. And part of also what makes this race so boring too is that the Democrats are split, and both Moon and Durkin are using the term progressive to describe themselves. Plus, Moon
using the term progressive,
right? Yeah. Like, they both describe themselves as not just Democrats but progressive Democrats. Mm-hmm. And while Durkin has received lots of money from the Chamber of Commerce, she's also gotten the endorsement of the Martin Luther King Labor Council. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Can I just say, I don't think this race is boring, and I don't think the candidates are very similar. I think there's a lot of differences between them, and I made one of those little charts that you do. So one is more self-financed than the other. One has more money. So Moon is more self-financed out of her total. Durkin has more money. Moon believes in a right to shelter, which is a very, very expensive proposition. If you read...
This is that having a place to live, the question at a debate was, should that be a right?
Thank you for doing that.
She said yes.
But then didn't she later modify that? She modifies and changes as everybody in the whole world does. Durkin is more for a right to affordable housing. Moon is for something that was brought up earlier and trounced citywide, the idea of homeless having access to living in the parks to a certain point. Durkin said no to that. You know, there are differences between these candidates on upzoning the city. If you live in a single family neighborhood, you should listen carefully to how they talk. So I don't think it's as boring as everybody does, unless you're going to say, oh, it's two women and they'll just figure it out, or the voters will. And I don't find it that.
I would say for Moon, I mean, I talked about Durkin's sort of liability. Moon's liability is that she just doesn't have the kind of experience, certainly running stuff, that Durkin does. I mean, Moon has not run a U.S. attorney's office, that kind of thing. So her resume is light on kind of a management, you know, kind of positions. And we haven't heard it much, but I assume we're going to start hearing it. I assume this money is going to start being spent on ads. You know, her big claim to fame, Moon, was her anti-tunnel stance. And that ended up being rejected by voters, basically. I mean, that went to a referendum. And so you could say that she was out of touch, or certainly was out
on the wrong end of
the majority.
She says, Carrie Moon says, she got important changes to the waterfront.
And I think that's true. But I wouldn't be surprised if you see a lot of targeted mailing in areas of town that really wanted the tunnel and were worried about the viaduct, like West Seattle and other places, that really hammer Dirk or Moon on her anti-tunnel position.
I think the tunnel's going to become more of a liability for Durkin going forward and more of an asset for Carrie Moon. I mean, she's got her transit bona fides behind her in a way that maybe Durkin has not been advocating as much. And I think that as the weeks go by, we're going to really see those transit differences hammered out between the two.
Can we talk about this idea of everybody's a progressive in Seattle? That it's, if everybody is something, then it doesn't mean much.
Well, around here, you don't say you're not progressive. This is a very liberal city. I've said this so many times here. I apologize. 31 flavors of left, you know, around here. And right now, as CR said, you know, somehow Jenny Durkin is with the establishment, but the establishment are all left themselves. And so this is just kind of a funny way to do this. You had suggested, I think you were taking on the job of the Oxford Dictionary, which adds words. Are you trying to go the other way?
Anybody think progressive?
I would like to retire the term progressive.
Sydney would like to retire it. Okay.
I'm not the first one with this hot take, by the way.
Okay. Just one thing about this, though. It has been a clear trend. I mean, for the last several election cycles, it's been a race to the left. And this is another race to the left. I mean, look at these candidates every day coming out with some new leftist idea. I mean, you had recently free community college proposed by Durkin. You had a workers' bill of rights proposed by Moon. You have rent subsidies proposed by Durkin. You have more paid sick leave by Moon. So I mean they are running as far to the left as they can.
So they are progressive.
So they are progressive.
So we pursued this topic on the last Civic Cocktail, and your very own boss was really helpful in sort of measuring
it. Pointing at Sydney, by the way.
I'm pointing at
the
Boston
Stranger.
And Tim Keck was, you know, I asked him, how do we measure this? How do we know we're more left? One example would be, there used to be Republicans on the city council. Haven't seen one of those in a long time. And there could be, there's one socialist, but there could be two when this election is done. That's different.
Yeah, but I don't think this measure of leftism is particularly instructive or helpful, because people are using the terms progressive and left to try and signify something, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to signify that they are the populist candidate, that they are for the everyman, which is something that we saw in the national election, right? But what's going to tell us whether they are helping the more vulnerable members of our society are their policies. So this is why I would like to see the term progressive retired and really judge these two candidates on the merits of their policies and individual experiences.
We were suggesting, instead of Burning Man, that Seattle could have Burning Word, a festival where you put the word progressive on top of the Seattle Public Library, the Central Library, and you just light it. and
you think fires are a good idea, right?
Dance around it. Yeah. It's getting wetter. Did you hear that it's snowing in the mountains and everything?
Sounds like October.
Seems to happen every year.
Sounds like October.
One more political note. As I say, we've got this election, 3 weeks away, and one of those elections could flip majority power in the legislature from a Republican Senate to a Democratic Senate to go along with a Democratic House and governor. CR, who's going to win this East Side seat, the 45th?
Well, if you look at the primary election and some polling, you say advantage Monica Dhingra, she's the Democrat running over there, against Jin-Young Anglin, been about 10 percentage points that have separated them in polls and certainly in the primary. So I would probably say she's in the better position. I'd probably rather be Dhingra right now than Anglin.
What are the main policies they disagree on?
Well, they have a big difference, and Anglin is trying to, in some ways, make this a referendum on Sound Transit. There's a lot of backlash against last year's Sound Transit vote and frustration that Sound Transit was using kind of inflated car tables and all that rest. And at a recent debate that Joni moderated, and I'm sure she'll talk about it, this came up. I mean, Anglin, the Republican, said, hey, we ought to get rid of that car tab tax for Sound Transit. And Dhingra said, you know, let's tweak the agency, but let's keep it. And that's a pretty big deal. I mean, if you want to get rid of the Sound Transit tax and kind of stop the system or keep it going, that's a pretty big divide.
So, yeah, I moderated this with Essex Porter. And, oh, my gosh, this was a really energetic debate. Both candidates stuffed the halls with their supporters. We had a no-clap rule that lasted about 4 seconds. And what I found in that room were a couple of things. I found, number one, that they were Donald Trump was in the room, although he wasn't actually there. It's not like a sighting or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so was Bob Ferguson, although he wasn't actually there. So they went back and forth on that. I found Ms. England seemed to be running against Seattle a little bit. A couple of times, you know, Seattle-style politics or Seattle solutions. And so I asked her about it. And she said, no, but, you know, she's running against Trump. So if you had to bet who was going to win, it probably is the Democrat, although Andy Hill, a very moderate Republican, has represented this district. As you said, this is for all the marbles in the legislature who shall control it. Safe injection sites were a big topic of debate. As far as I know, there is no safe injection site even proposed for this district, although it's possible because there's some siting. And
this is Kirkland, Duval, Sammamish,
sort of
basically
zone Microsoft, basically.
Redmond, yeah.
Right. So, but they went back and forth on that. Neither of them was for it. Neither of them was for it in the 45th, although Dhingra was for it in Seattle if they wanted it, something like that. That's close to what they had said. It was, and certainly 405, if you want to talk about transportation, is another part of it.
You're talking about the tolls?
Yes.
Anger over the tolls?
One of the audience members asked, I thought, one of the better questions, does Sound Transit need legislative oversight? So a question handed to us. And that was pretty pointed. They both want oversight. Of course, who says,
I don't want any oversight.
Yeah. Just
that is the proper answer.
Just party on with whatever money you want to spend. Yeah. But, you know, Sound Transit is hot over there. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can tell that state Republicans are really concerned about this race because it seems like they keep trying to characterize Dhingra as a friend to far left policies. But as you mentioned, Joni, like both of them are kind of, I mean, England is anti-safe injection sites, she said.
But
Dhingra is also, she's not an advocate for
them. Right.
I think a bigger, we should take a statewide focus in this race because it could swing the balance of power so significantly, especially when it comes to gun legislation. This is a key race that advocates of safe gun legislation are looking at because over the last several years, we could talk about decades state Democrats have tried to push through gun legislation and it's just gone absolutely nowhere. Like last year, Attorney General Bob Ferguson called for a ban on assault weapons. That proposal went absolutely nowhere. So now we have advocates for safe gun legislation going directly to the ballot. If this If DINGRA wins this race, it would be much easier to pass gun legislation in piecemeal ways through the state legislature.
Just because of one difference in one seat?
I'm not sure that's true.
Are they so partisan and unanimous?
I'm not sure because some rural Democrats won't vote for it. So I'm not sure. It seems to me that the ballot, and I don't love this. I think lawmakers should do their job, and I think they should pass gun legislation, you know, a lot more than they've already done. But if you put the right thing on the ballot, we've learned a couple of times here in this state that the voters are way ahead of the legislature on gun legislation. And if it's sensible and reasonable, they'll do it. Their lawmakers are too scared of the NRA to do it.
I think it does open the way for a possible gun control measure. We'll see. It certainly opens the way for a number of things on the Inslee agenda. I mean, there is no secret that Inslee has tried as much as he can to get control of the state Senate, the one house he has not controlled since he's become governor. He wants it bad. So there must be something there. I mean, the feeling is that if he gets control of the state Senate, much of his agenda will be green lit.
Yeah.
Carbon tax, capital gains tax, perhaps gun control legislation. I mean, Democrats and Inslee are putting a lot in this, so they feel like they got a lot at stake. And Republicans realize that, which is why there is so much money going into this. It will be the most expensive state legislative race in our history.
Well, in all fairness, another item that was discussed over there was the property tax increase that was put in many of, it was certainly in the 45th, to pay for education. And, you know, this is maybe one of the key issues is, would they have been able to block this, the Democrats, if that seat had been in Democratic hands? Because that's a big wallop over there. It's like $800 or something.
Speaking of guns, if the semi-automatic rifle ban is so popular, why hasn't it gone to a state initiative already?
They're probably writing it as you're talking.
Yeah.
But this has been years people have been calling for this.
Well, in order to get a statewide initiative passed, you have to, I think, in talking to advocates for safer gun legislation, their approach seems to be to try and find consensus, right? To try and find things on which both Democrats and Republicans agree. And as Joni mentioned, the voters in the state are far, far ahead of our legislators who won't do anything that the NRA might object to. And I think
couldn't
that,
agree more.
Yeah, and I.
Yeah, but I'm asking why it's not.
Well, you know what? These come as national sort of sweeping. Like, you know, the last measure came out of, you know, every town, and they take their measures, background checks, they take their measures around to different states. So maybe it needs that kind of money in it, potentially.
The initiative that was on the ballot a couple of years ago was universal background checks, and that had wide bipartisan support. I mean, that was a sort of easy one, if you will, in terms of going to the voters, and it's passed a number of places since it passed here. Semi-assault weapons bans is trickier. It doesn't have as much support, might have a majority support in Washington, but it's not as universally supported. A lot of guns, upwards of half guns that are sold, are probably under the category of semi-automatic. So a lot of gun owners, even Democrat gun owners, they're more concerned about this semi-automatic ban and how far that goes. So it's a trickier thing than background checks.
The ballot initiative approach seems to be approached this in a piecemeal way. Another great success that we had was extreme risk protection orders, right? That was something that had
very
bipartisan
truly
support. And I think that's a much easier notion, this idea of common sense gun legislation to pass than a quote ban on assault weapons, because gun owners, again, are going to question what an assault weapon even means. And I think that a lot of Democrats lack the vocabulary to talk to Republicans about guns.
That's one thing, you know, just to put an exclamation point on something that CR just said. So what I've observed about ballot measures, especially on controversial issues like guns, they sort of have to be, they have to start out at something like 68 or 70% favorability. And then they have enough heft to pass the opposition that will then bring those down to like maybe 55, 56% support. I think one was 60%, to be fair. But you have to start high. So it has to be something that a lot of people believe in. If it's too tricky or too controversial, it'll get trashed before it gets started.
My guess is there'll be a move on these bump stocks.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, both candidates that debated on the 45th district are in favor of banning those bump stocks. That seems
these are the devices that turn a semi-automatic
Post-Las
rifle.
Vegas, yeah, yeah.
You've got to be pretty weird to be.
That was clearly used
on
there,
an opposite
and
position
it,
for that.
It looks like that movement is probably going to show up in a number of states, may even show up nationally. In fact, even Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who's been pretty friendly to gun rights, of course, he is suggesting that ATF actually just change the rule on bump stocks, and
Congress won't have to vote on
and they
it.
Don't
Congress
have to do won't anything. Have to vote That's on their it. Favorite yeah. day at work. Yeah. They yeah. love that.
So it looks like bump stocks may happen at the federal level anyway.
Okay, regarding the Seattle mayoral campaign, Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin are going to be on this show on Monday. So I'm asking you, listener, to email us or tweet, Facebook, what do you want me to ask them? Joni's going to ask them later. Well, I'm going to ask
still
them
on
earlier.
The question, are you sharing this or not?
the email address is record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, Twitter, it's @KUOW, and Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. So that's about our time, team. We've got the U.S. Education Secretary coming into town tonight in Bellevue, the Hyatt Regency. Could be protests there. We've got snow starting to fall. And we'll do this again next week. I want to thank everybody for coming around and figuring out what happened this week and why it matters. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jolly that, fun. Thank you.
What was that?
Jolly fun.
Jolly fun. Really jolly. That is Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger, C.R. Douglas, political analyst with Q13 News. Great to see you. We'll be back again on Monday.